new episode of The Brand Called You. Today, I have someone I have known for 2 decades, young person, someone I hold in very, very high regard, Sharif Rangnekar. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sharif is a former journalist with The Economic Times and The Pioneer. He's a communications consultant. He is chairman and CEO of Integral PR. You know, he did work with me when we were founding Guardian. He's advocate to change and garner support for the LGBTQ community. He's the founder of the Dvijen Dinanath Arts Foundation. He's an author of 2 books. He's a TEDx speaker. And he's a director of the Rainbow Lit Fest. My God, Sharif, what an amazing journey you've had so far. Talk to me a little bit about some of your early life and some of your learnings.
I think early life as in my career or something like that. I think, you know, I think the one of the greatest things that I've kind of figured out about myself is curiosity. And I think that curiosity and just this whole I'm not a person who keeps reading books. I'm not I'm not the brightest academic as such. So, but what I figured in life was meeting people, engaging with them, and from them learning a lot. And I think that's been my journey, and that's how I think when I moved into journalism, there was a certain amount of satiation of knowledge as such, that and the ability to reach out to people, because you know when you're a journalist those days, where actually the pen spoke and said so much and shared so much with society at large. That we, as a journalist, used to get this chance to not just meet people, but constantly get to know what is happening around. Mm-hmm. And so, in that sense, I think the inability or the failure to be a good student necessarily was being I was covering up with all of that through the journey of journalism. Mm-hmm. I think, and I think those were my greatest days, and that hasn't gone away, because I think just meeting you also today after so long is like brings back many things that I can recall about Guardian or about your books and the small things that we did together. So I think at every stage, I think the base has always been about people and learning from them.
Fantastic.
So I think that's what it is.
So tell me a little bit, you know, after journalism, you moved into PR.
Yeah.
And, you know, at one stage, you were one of the biggest and best known PR companies with you at the head. How was the transition from journalism to public relations?
I think people perceived that it was a tough transition, but I think it wasn't really for me. Mm-hmm. Because I had already become part of a group well-known journalist, M.K. Veno, and myself, mm-hmm. we started doing these knowledge enhancement programs. So we were engaging with a lot of the PR people in another group company. And what I did, again, I guess when I look back on life, was this joy of learning something new made it easy for me. And I think somewhere I hadn't forgotten the psyche of being a journalist, the psyche of how he seeks news, how she seeks news, or they seeks news. You know, news. Now you have to be careful about your pronouns, of how you address people. So I think that made it a little easy for me to move from one end to another. And again, I think I was fortunate to have certain clients where research, content development were critical parts of what they were doing. So it made me easier. I think I was not that comfortable with consumer products. Because even as a journalist, for us, a consumer product, if you're just hawking or selling that, advertise it then, right? There's no story per se unless it's an invention or if it's a corporate story. So I think I was uncomfortable during the early years of consumer than vis-a-vis, let's say, thought leadership, public policy and those areas, you know? So I think that was the only challenge I really faced in the transition. But I guess just wanting to know something and learning from your team that you work with has all, I think, made it easier for me. Mm-hmm.
So tell me, you know, again, PR over the last 2 or 3 decades has been changing dramatically. And to an outsider. We are in New Delhi, meant someone who had an inside track to the corridors of power.
Yeah.
And I've worked with you long enough, and I know you were in a very different league.
Yeah.
Where I understood you as pure PR, as everyone in the world understands. How do you think PR is changing in India?
See, I think it's evolved in many ways, because if you see the rise of issues and crisis, it really comes from a PR agency who knows how to build as well as protect an image. So I think that's a big space that the public relations has gone into. The other thing that has also happened is the industry has invested a lot on content and knowledge. So what you've had is people moving in, let's say from the legal fraternity, people moving in from who have qualifications in CA, in science, in engineering, they're also getting into public relations. There are people with a background in math stats, for example. They've also gone. And then there's this whole analytics, you know, piece which has also come in. So I think at one level, PR itself has driven change, but at another level, the demands and the requirements of clients today are hugely different.
Correct.
You know, with the 24/7 kind of, you know, social media, etc., etc. So when you look at, let's say, the staffing that we would have about 10, 12 years ago, average age is very different from the average age today, because you need people on their toes. You need people who know how to use gadgets, who understand technology as well, other than communication. So I think that whole landscape has changed. But what also I think has happened is when you have politicians turning to PR and becoming, you know, great leaders through storytelling, through script writing, through speeches and talks like that, it's an arrival of public relations in a very, very different way.
True.
And which advertising alone can't do. You know, so I think that's what has been happening, and it's got an incredible future. I think there are agencies who would perhaps try to influence journalists, and things like that.
Okay.
There were also, in a city like Delhi, I think there was a whole bunch of people who have this tendency, ki main isko janta hu, isko janta hu, etc. And some they did know. So there was a lot of meeting that would take place, and things. It wasn't necessarily that always that the PR man went and fixed something. So I think there was this constant suspicion. Because perhaps the early players who were there in public relations was doing government affairs, and that government affairs invariably was, you know, carrying a suitcase and things like that. So that took a long time for the industry to kind of, I think, with newer players coming in who brought in the change in perception.
No, that's well said. That's well said. So, no, my question was a follow-up of that itself, to say that if I am a new business and I'm looking for a PR agency, what should I look for?
I think you really need to figure out any of the PR agencies that come forth. Is one is they typically will give you a presentation, etc., etc. I think you need to question the presentation and look at it. You need to look at the quality of content in that presentation. I think you need to look at the quality of people who are going to be servicing that account. And see the experience not necessarily only in years, but of the kind of clients they worked in. I think it's great to have an interaction, because ultimately what happens is it's a people's business, so they engage with you. And so you need to have that comfort, you need to feel that, you know, as a good businessman, you will know the kind of people, because they're your team, they become your team. You need to also allow that to happen.
True.
But when they become your team, or you assuming that they're going to be, you need to feel that kind of vibe. Are they on the same page? Do they understand your business? You need to figure those basic things out. If you were hiring anyone into your organization, is he the flag bearer? Is he going to carry your? Is he going to be your champion? I think those kind of things you need. It's a very it's an instinct that you have to have, just like you have an instinct for the business, you know. And obviously, everyone comes with networks.
Correct.
That's important. But I think today people, if they got good content and they know how to pitch, then the network doesn't matter, because good content will always, you know, move forward.
Correct.
And it'll always find its way.
Mm.
So I think those are two or three things you need to really look for.
So Sharon, let's move to the next segment, which is, you know, the LGBTQ community. Over the years, societal acceptance is changing in our country. What do you think can be done to improve this significantly faster?
See, I think it is changing, but it's also not changing in many ways. I think we need to understand that there have been more and more hate crimes of late than there were before.
Okay.
Yes, it could be possible that we're getting to know more of the hate crimes than we knew before, because more people are coming out as well.
Right.
So there is all of that also happening. I think it's not easy in a country like ours to bring societal change, or even assume that things have changed dramatically everywhere, because there are enough stories, even after Section 377 was read down. Within 2 months, there was a friend of mine, I mean, not a very close friend, but we knew each other. He committed suicide. It was, you know, depression. And why that depression? We all know. I've been through depression. I know what it is about. I was speaking to friends at Hamsafar Trust, and they, amongst the largest NGOs working in the space, they're having just a very high number of calls coming in, and another death happened in February.
Wow.
Then in Chennai, it was in the newspapers about a young schoolboy committing suicide because he was bullied. Then a lesbian girl in Madhya Pradesh was tied to a tree and beaten up. That was also in the news. So I think when we're looking at India, we need to look at region to region.
Correct.
It's just like any
Correct.
Business when Correct. You look at, or anything.
Correct.
We have islands of what we call development, and we have spaces which are like exceedingly dark or cotton time. So really, I think the responsibility today is like major influencers in this country who hopefully are empathetic and understand what it is to be queer or to be different, that if they can also carry messages, that's
Correct.
One part.
Correct.
And I think cinema, press need to play a huge role in this. I think to expect much from governments and politicians is too much, but we need to, the press should have, and we ourselves should have made our governments across states as well and the center accountable in what 377 order said, which was sensitizing society. So sensitization of society or bringing societal change comes from a lot of communication. That communication has to be multi-level. If you are building a scheme in this country today to reach out to millions of people, you have advertising, you have people working on ground, you go and sensitize the police, you go and sensitize the, you know, doctors need sensitization, sadly, in this country, because there are still people who are giving conversion therapy.
Yeah.
So I think there are just so many layers that things need to be done to bring change.
In fact, you know,
and
you
I
just,
think schools.
Yeah, you just mentioned about police. You know, they are the most basic or lowest level of enforcers, if I can use that term.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you that, do governments or state governments have any communication plan about 377 to the police?
You know, I believe some state governments have done things. Now, whether they have a larger plan, one doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Some people also, even in corporates, are ticking the box also, because it's a good thing to
do.
It's not necessarily a thing that you must do, have to, good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's not, it is a good thing.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't think there is a plan. I don't think there is a sense of compulsion to do such things. And I think let's keep aside the police for a minute.
Sure.
But what about schools?
Correct.
What about universities and colleges?
Parents.
Parents.
Yeah.
You know, so parents can, I think, there are, again, I mean, you know, I don't think there's a one thing that you have to do. I mean, I think you need more press telling you stories, and those voices, that we hear shouldn't be necessarily mine and with my kind of background. We need the voices from across the country.
Correct.
Because everyone comes with a different story. Everyone comes with a different level of access to a system, to privilege.
Correct.
So I think that's a huge problem we face, because we find the same 5 to 8 or 10 people speaking every time in the press. And most of us who speak come with a very secure background.
Correct.
I can be safe at home. I'm safe here.
Yeah.
I'm not fearing that you'll pounce on me or abuse me, right? Now, how many have that space is a thing. So where are those voices? Where are those stories? So that, I think that it's a huge communication campaign, if you want to call it. But it's not going to be a campaign that can be completely structured, because issues in Manipur are very different from Goa or Kerala or UP.
Correct.
You know, and so I think there's just so much out there to be done, and it's
That's
I think schools is where you start.
Also. That's true. When I was reading up about you, you know, before I'm going to talk to you, I read an interesting article where there were some different views, and some people actually said that Section 377 has fragmented the movement. What are your thoughts?
See, I think what has happened is post 377, I don't think it's really fragmented the movement. I think in the same way, see, you've had a Nalsa judgment earlier, 2014, which have to do with the transgender community and things like that. And that didn't get executed and implemented. So there are certain divisions between the trans community as such, the transgender community and the rest. But post 377, what has happened is really, at this point, the community still seems to be celebrating that order rather than getting together to figure out what next.
What next?
Because I think there's also a large number of people who are going around claiming it's pure love or it's all about love and love wins. And things like that. That's like fake 2-hour love stories where you never know what happened after the 2 hours of that relationship. So I think people have gone overboard. The press has gone overboard to make this seem like such a big milestone. And they've kind of... it's led to a lot of good things. I'm not talking about that. But it's given a false sense of freedom when you aren't. Because all you can do is not be picked up by the police for consensual sex.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Correct.
That is it. Correct. There's nothing as basic as basic can be. So when there is this has led to, I think, a situation like where no one knows exactly what we should do. Because earlier, earlier when you were fighting one law collectively. Today, you don't know. Some people want marriage, whereas marriage is actually a choice. And ask a lot of married couples, they'll tell you about marriage.
Correct.
Not commenting on everyone's marriage.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. And there is an issue of civil rights. Now, if the focus is, let's say, on marriage rights, it's a big problem. What happens to the kids who go to schools? Do they get to get married to get certain rights?
Correct.
And those rights are related to a marriage. They are not related to basic existence, where today I feel safer, anti-discrimination is being addressed, where my rights at the workplace, where I'm protected in a school, in a college, or where I have a voice to freely say something that needs to happen in the education system. Those rights are not being protected. The rights that even, let's say, for example, if in another period of time or a place I was, suppose I'd come out and people were hostile against my mother, how would I protect her and protect that structure? And, you know, there are many other things. Okay, that doesn't necessarily need a law, but many other things that are not there in place. And so that's where the division is, because firstly, your press is heteronormative. They're carrying the heterosexual thing that everyone wants to get married. You know, they've forgotten that love can happen without a marriage.
True. I agree.
And there could be multiple partners.
Yeah.
Right. Why not?
Oh,
yeah. So how does that fit in? So, you know, that's where the fragmentation, I think, is on what is our priority.
So, today. You know, moving, this is an interesting segue now into my next question. You know, we spoke about schools a little earlier and you just spoke about it. My question to you is, at what stage in a school do we start to talk about they, if I can use the term? At what stage does a child start to understand their sexual reality?
See, I think one is the language reality, and I think it's a really tough one. I think this debate is going on even in the West, because only the word they as has been incorporated
recently in
the dictionaries.
Yeah.
I still identify myself as he and a cisgender. Even the word cis was something I myself was not used to, because I come from a different vocabulary and time. But there's a general sense, like in the debates that are taking place in UK, and we aren't very different in that when it comes to the English speaking population, let's say, and in certain schools. I think by page 12 or 13 is considered a good time to start educating people about these things. I think the challenge that would come is, how do you teach grammar today?
Correct.
Also, and when should that be then done? Because if you're teaching grammar when they're already in class 1 or 2 or 3, then where does the say? So I think that hasn't yet not been addressed, and I don't think anyone has a very clear answer on that. But I think by the time the child is 12 or 13 is a good time for them to know, because today they're also growing up with much more access to information. I mean, obviously, people are also pulling back on technology and how much do you use phones and, you know, all that is there. But that would be a safe age. And it's very, very, very critical, because I don't think any generation moving forward needs to go through the dilemmas and the fears and the suicidal tendencies, depression or sense of loneliness or sense of not being able to fit into society, things that are even fit in a home, that they need to go through that when we have the option, when we have the knowledge, when we have the awareness.
Correct.
And we have enough case studies today of how it can help and how it doesn't if you don't. Do these things, it should happen, and I don't think school should hesitate. I think they don't need to look at today. They need to, what do schools do? They prepare you also for tomorrow.
Correct.
If they can't do that, then they ought not to be in that business.
Correct. I agree with you.
Yeah.
So let's move to the next part, which are three of your interests, you know.
Oh.
The Dvijen Dinanath Arts Foundation, and you are a musician, you've got an album coming out in June. Talk to me about the foundation and your album.
See, I think the foundation was like, when I quit my 9-to-5, I was heavily impacted by my brother, because I think one thing my brother did extremely well was his idea of protection was to free someone.
Okay.
And,
that's very well said.
You know, and I think, and he used to tell me many things that, you know, I've got a network of people which I didn't realize I had, because I never made friends or engaged with people to build a network. Those just happened because of the work I did.
Correct.
Also.
And so, your personality.
Yeah, maybe, whatever. Yeah. But it's just, I had this thing and you know, I felt everyone was contributing one way or the other to my own growth.
Correct.
As a person. So, is it that you have those skills, you have this, and if you're not happy constantly serving a corporate or even, you know, at times not sharing enough information with the press because you had to, because that was the mandate from a client, then do something that makes you happier.
Mm.
And it was always about social justice and rights, and that's an area I was also started writing quite a bit at that point. So that's how this, so after he passed away, the thing was I need to structure this. I created a platform called Embrace Music Justice Arts, which is now branded and owned by the foundation. Mm-hmm. But the platform came before the foundation came.
Okay.
And it was the idea of using these various tools of communication, which is music, talk, arts, they're all communicating something. Everyone's telling a story through that. But addressing issues of social justice of society, things we don't talk about, things that the press doesn't talk about, stories that we normally don't get to hear. So it was and obviously the idea of independence, that why are indie artists, you know, do they have to only go down the commercial route to be included?
Correct.
Which means there's a prototype, there's a template, and all of that. Why does everyone have to fit into these boxes?
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's where it really kicked off from, which as a result, in what, about 2 years, we've had over 100 plus musicians perform at different events, where we've rediscovering genres, where we've talked about Bob Dylan's music, and I mean his songwriting, about war, anti-war, pro-peace, John Lennon, you know, things like that. So we would use all of these tools. We've had different campaigns also kick off. I think one of the people on Suparna had been at our first, and so we kicked off the Let's Talk Period campaign at an Embrace event foundation, actually. And we had Voice in the Silence, and we co-presented the Lit Fest as well. So that's where it really kind of started from, and it's now getting into its third year. It's the first time I'm really planning, because you have to look at funding and various other things. It's very, very tough. And so that's where this came from. And I guess I've always, I grew up with you know, Pink Floyd and Roger Waters' writings on war and politics and other things, on capitalism of a certain kind, with Dylan and things. So I think there was always a strong belief that these have a role to play. And today, if you see movements taking place any part of the world, and if you look at African movements from all the countries there, music's played a very important role. You know?
In fact, and Dylan, Dylan and Lennon are both my vintage. I grew up listening to a lot of them.
They're still amazing.
I agree.
So, you know, there's, so I think that's where all these things came, kind of came together.
Very interesting.
And even the album and the music is along those lines as such. I mean, who can't be a Bob Dylan? Because only he knows how to sing the way he sings and writes the way he does. And you can't be a John Lennon, because you can't have the same passion, you don't have the same background as
but,
he did.
But you can be a Sharif Rangnekar,
who's
writing, you're singing, and you're putting together, composing the music. Tell me a little bit about your album, if you're open to talk about.
I mean, I would say the album has some amazing artists who've kind of contributed to songs. There are well-known indie artists like Adhir Ghosh, Smithy Malik, and all, who happen to now live in Gurgaon, who've been involved in composing India's first track dedicated to the LGBTQ community, which is called Head Held High. And so they were actively involved. It was a poem I had written one day, which was inspired by Rabindranath Tagore's, you know, Where the Mind is Without Fear. And then they worked on a few other songs, but after that, over a period of time, there have been musicians. There were a quartet from Venezuela just before the crisis hit its worst period, who worked on another song called Silence. They provided all the strings. Then there are two Brit artists based in Taipei, but they used to be in London earlier, who worked on 3-4 other songs with me. So, but the music essentially is not one genre. It's you have a country rock feel to some songs, you have a reggae-ish feel to another, you have a more jazzy, bluesy feel to things. So there isn't one genre. I think it's just whatever tune came to mind, and how this poem kind of fitted in with that, and how to work around that. So that's been the
amazing
mix. But
amazing.
Yeah, so there's songs on crony capitalism. There's a song on freedom of expression. There's on urging the community to come out, called Why Do You Hide? And, you know, which is kind of a country rock, very unusual for what's considered queer music. But that's what it is. And they have the covers been done by an incredible artist, a really beautiful person. Anvesh Sahu used to be, was once India's Mr. Gay India 2016. He's a very, very talented person. He's done the cover. The cover's ready. It's just the production work is going on at this point.
So, Sharif, I only have time for one more question. And I'm going to ask you this it's a question about mentorship. Over the years, have you had any mentors? And if yes, because you moved from journalism to PR to music.
Yeah, you know, I think,
what have you learned from those mentors?
See, I think I'll name them. I think one of my mentors was M.K. Venu.
Hmm.
I didn't just learn journalism from him. I learned life.
Okay.
I think because he opened my mind, you know, as a reporter, you have, there are like three beats, then you're looking at those three beats.
Mm-hmm.
But his outlook was, how does any of those beats impact society
mm-hmm.
at large and life and consumption?
Mm-hmm.
And he would bring in cultural aspects of behavior,
mm-hmm.
consumption, all of those things.
Yeah.
That literally opened my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the other is his wife,
mm-hmm.
who would do that in a very, very
mm-hmm.
different way.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I would learn so many things of how to just, not necessarily, how to accept also who I am,
mm-hmm.
you know, comes
mm-hmm.
from mentors like
correct.
Them,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
It frees you then
yeah.
much more
yeah.
in what output you can give to anything that
true.
You do. So,
true.
I think they were too. The other mentor, which I didn't realize, was my brother, actually,
mm-hmm.
my late brother. And because, as I said, that his idea was always to free you. I mean, his idea
mm-hmm.
Was never to keep telling, putting fears in your mind.
Correct.
You know,
correct.
So his idea of protection was like that, to be
mm-hmm.
that middle brother. So he also, I think he mentored me in a certain way, very subtly and cleverly, by
mm-hmm.
commenting on pieces I would write.
Okay.
And then argue with me on a point. Well, it improved the way I think.
Correct.
You know, so I think they're not typical mentors, as you
mm-hmm.
would normally
mm-hmm.
call, you know, like you have a mentorship
yeah,
program
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
I think people who free your mind,
who've had
open
an impact
them,
on your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're the ones who will always have an
absolutely.
Impact on you.
Absolutely.
I think that change, that makes who you are.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Sharif, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure reconnecting with you, chatting
you
with you.
Happy to have.
And I wish you lots of success with your album.
Yeah.
With the Lit Fests. I'm sure there'll be another one in 2020.
Absolutely.
And with
yes.
everything else that you do.
No,
thank you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank
you. Thank
you. Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for the Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.